you always kind of wonder about these contingencies. I mean, that's what history essentially is, and that's what's exciting and kind of tantalizing about it to me, is the contingencies. Like, why do we draw the line at 3,000? Why don't we include sort of everything before that? There's reasons, obviously, but it is like a kind of, you know, it's kind of a convenient line, as it were. The other thing that immediately came to my mind when you said that quote was the very end of it, which is living hand to mouth, right? Which implies that there is something of a kind of, so like someone who is living hand to mouth is living, you know, moment to moment, paycheck to paycheck, as it were, right? They don't have a surplus to draw on. They make something and then they consume it. You know, they construct something and then they use it. They weave something and then it wears out, as it were. So they're kind of always living in this desperation. It's not a state that you necessarily want to live in, but it's one which you can, you know, we have this dichotomy now, surviving versus thriving. Whereas the person who can live off 3,000 years is thriving because they have that historical surplus that affords them the kind of comfort of living not just in their own time, as it were, you know?
Yeah, you pointed out the other aspect of that quote that I thought was really interesting. And, like, I think you had a more eloquent way of putting it. My immediate mental imagery went to more like an, I think you had this more, you said more eloquently, but almost like an animalistic way, in the sense of, like, you're living hand to mouth, you're living in the moment, you're living wildly, you're almost living like an animal. And animals don't really have a history, right? They kind of, each generational sect, there's some, you know, sometimes there's evolution and behavior, and I guess you could say that's like, maybe that's like the most fundamental basics of a historical change, like subconscious historical change or whatever. But really, generationally, animals are living within their own section of time, right? And they're living instinctually, as you kind of said. They're living just for survival, and they're not being able to reflect back and draw upon more articulated findings or ideas or discoveries of their ancestors, right? Which then, you know, obviously build back into a kind of story or narrative, as we talked about like what our own time is or our own life is or what it means to be a person or, you know, how these sorts of big questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In particular, too, it seems that, I mean, you can think of examples of animals like storing food or, you know, going into long periods of like hibernation or something like that, but they don't have the kind of surplus that we would necessarily have, right? Like animals don't collect food and then, well, some do, this is the thing. I'm thinking of like bears or something. They eat a lot of food and then they go and hibernate. But I'm thinking in particular the kind of surplus that allows for something like luxury or what we consider or like what we think of when we think that, you know, the pursuit that we're engaged in, philosophy, the fine arts, history, etc. There's something super abundant about it, right? There's something that allows you to actually elevate yourself out of your particular situation. And that gives you a sort of, it's almost like a materialist way of producing intellectual distance, right? Because you don't have to labor in that particular moment. You can set aside time to distance yourself from your situation. And that's like a material condition for reflection, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not something that like we all can do, apparently. But I think this is loosely with a quote kind of applies to what I wanted to talk kind of also kind of very just loosely about. It's something we've sort of mentioned before, but I was just reading up on some other items on the topic, which is, you know, again, Gotha mentioned the 3,000 years, and obviously the one of the most important, you know, elements of change in that 3,000 year mark or in that 3,000 year period is the, you know, rise of Christianity, and, you know, the life of Jesus Christ himself, and then also probably more importantly the transition that happened in both philosophy, thought, and kind of, you know, belief around identity that happened because of this sort of really basically revolution that took place over multiple centuries, but started with the life of ostensibly this one guy, which we know, which we actually know, you know, a pretty limited amount about. But it's really interesting because within that period, especially, okay, like, you know, running off of Gotha, the 3,000 year era, that first 1,000 years is kind of that the year of heroes, of heroics, right? It's the Greco, especially when we think about the Greek world, the Greco world, and Alexander the Great and all that kind of stuff, and then running into the Roman Empire as well. We've talked about it before. It was a pagan world, and like even talking about pagan religion in that period is really complicated because it was just like so diverse. But there were pretty consistent ideas and strands that ran through them. And one of them was certainly militaristic, right? That like that success and heroics were determined by, you know, by victory and conquest and whatever that might be, or that, you know, revenge is taken from like overthrowing subjugation and all this kind of stuff. Again, these are all really material things. Another one is the idea around like the soul and the body and the connection there, and also with that relationship as well, the relationship to death and what death and dying means. Most people, it's a broad statement, I want to say ahead of time, but most people in the pagan world did not have significant conceptions of the afterlife. There's obviously some, you know, this is like, you know, there's obviously some leeway in this, but most pagans thought that they, when they passed away, you know, they, when they, you had your body, you lived your life, and you were, and if you, you know, if you were seriously pagan, your life was favored by the gods. It was heroic, and you know, leading back into history, you would be adding to your historical clan, country, you know, family, whatever, right? You would be imbuing honor upon, you know, yourself and your familial relations. But like you, the person, when they die, they're dead, right? Whether it's Alexander the Great was headed to godship and gods are immortal, but in what sense that actually meant, I'm not like going to get into, because it's not something that I'm fully aware of. Because even the deification of, you know, real persons is not really like, I think, the same thing as like a full, you know, god understanding.
There is like a very particularly pagan idea behind the difference between hero worship and apotheosis. Apotheosis is the transition from being immortal to being divine, right? So one actually attains, yeah, exactly, some kind of godhood.
Exactly. And the you know, the idea that that actually happened and the ways in which it happened are like pretty questionable and obviously shift from culture to culture. But again, the main thing going back to, like, most people believe that when you died, you were effectively, we could call it annihilation, right? Body and soul, body and mind both disappeared. Even Judaism actually had this, more or less this idea. There's this idea in Judaism of Sheol, which is the afterlife, as you know, it's kind of maybe sort of an afterlife, but it's often kind of referred to as like the shadow realm. It's like you don't really exist there, but like it's, you know, you kind of float. It's like almost like a ghost in the nothing. Is maybe one way of thinking about it. So like one step away from annihilation, basically. And the other idea is, you know, this idea of like stationhood and status and relationship in, and by extension, probably the best way to put it is identity within, you know, the Greco-Roman world. Familial relationships were extremely important. You know, family lines, and that's obviously, it's never fully disappeared, but things like family lines, familial relationships, kinship relationships, you know, nation relationships, all these kinds of things. These things, you know, had a huge determining factor on who you were always going to be, right? Like social climbing and all that kind of stuff in the ancient world was pretty, like, there was kind of the aristocracy and there was everyone else. And, you know, occasionally people could get rich and they can get involved, especially within, like, the Roman period. But generally speaking, like, you were never going to go from being a plebeian to being an aristocrat. Like, that was just not that kind of thing. And more importantly, your relationship to, like, the divine and the world, in the most fundamental aspect, was also displayed in that relationship, right? Like, there was something literally better about you fundamentally because you were from an aristocratic class, or you because you were from whatever leadership or familial line or whatever, right? And I, you know, I was recently doing some reading on how, like, Christianity really took all these sorts of ideas and sort of flipped them on their head, right? The first big one, you know, this is getting a little bit into, like, the history of early Christianity, but, like, the idea of a Messiah within the Jewish religion, which was, like, quite a small subset of the Mediterranean ancient world at the time, was for the longest time understood to be some sort of military human, like, kind of like an actual person, first of all, but like a man who was imbued, who was divine, kind of like the classic chosen one arc, right? Who would take, you know, the Jews, the Jewish community, and would, you know, like, you know, militarize them and be, you know, successful economically and overthrow the yoke of the Romans or whoever it was. And that would be the leader that would, you know, kind of free the Jewish people. But this was a material activity, right? Like, this was a material revolution. And then you get this guy Jesus showing up, and he's claiming to be the Messiah, and obviously has the most historically relevant Messiah complex, or whatever, if you want to call it, where he more or less turns this completely on its head and takes an entirely pacifistic tone to this position. This, I think, is just like a huge adjustment, and then obviously he was persecuted and killed, and it created the whole mythology, the whole story that became the Christian religion. But it's a totally, you know, new sort of idea of what being good is, and what being, not reviled, but revered by, you know, by God, or spiritually being righteous is a great way of putting it. Being righteous actually looks like. So I thought that was a really interesting and very significant change that took place because of the Christian religions, because, you know, I say the teachings of Jesus, but I always say that with, like, a little bit of the couching it, because really it was the teachings of Jesus that were then taken upon by the following Christian evolution.
Yeah, you don't have the teaching of Jesus applied except through the promulgation of those teachings. And the promulgation is that community that actually kind of dispenses them and interprets them and finds particular situations in which to use them.
Yeah, exactly, right? And thinking about as well, also too, there was this massive shift as well in terms of, like, one's relationship to, and I think this is part of the reason why I love to understand, like, why Christianity was so, you know, so effective and obviously influential, and still is today, right? And one of those as well is this, you know, this idea that introducing that there is in fact some sort of afterlife, right? That there are just rewards for those who are righteous members, you know, of the flock, right? And that being a right, and this gets into the kind of third point as well in terms of identity, but that, like, righteous members of the flock, like, this opportunity for glory, for eternal life, et cetera, that these things are accessible to all persons, right? Like, to all people. And this is also one of the big shifts as well, is shifting away from being, like a Jewish-oriented religion to being a really globalized, accepting, you know, religious faction that accepts all people. You know, the Apostle Paul, famously, spread the Jewish word among the Gentiles, which was like the terminology at the time for, for basically anyone who wasn't a Jew, right? So particularly people living in, with Paul, particularly living within Greece and then, the Italian peninsula and stuff like that. But so I just think it was really interesting as well that you see this transition away from being like, look, like your life, you know, when you sort of offer up a philosophy or a theology where, and it's an ethical system, right? It becomes an ethical question of, you know, the way that you live your life now will be judged, in terms, will be the key to entering the kingdom or, not entering the kingdom. And so here's all these tenets and laws and rules and ethical standards that that we're going to impose, primarily at least orienting from, this more pacifistic, Jesus-oriented religious tradition that you need to, live out and codify to be able to access this eternal life. But this eternal life is accessible to you whether you're the king of some, major kingdom, or whether you're a peasant tilling fields, wherever that may be. And I think that's, again, another revolution in terms of like a kind of accessibility of membership and unification of identity as well, right? Like, if we're all trying to get to the same sort of goal, if we're all believing in the same sort of system, then we kind of have a unified set of moral standards that we can judge ourselves against. And also these moral standards eventually, kind of transcend even like localized and linguistic boundaries and cultural boundaries as well.
Yeah, that is interesting that specifically that it transcends just like any kind of community boundary or anything like that. And I think it does come down to the sort of universalizable idea that the notion of like judgment plays. It has this almost like retroactive effect on all kinds of action that any particular person could take, such that it doesn't matter whether you're a peasant or a king, your actions will be judged, and they'll be judged according to this particular, not like a standard, but whether you will make it into the kingdom afterwards, right? And so it does have this, I want to use the term leveling, but I know that that is like a, considering that we just talked about Kierkegaard, I think that would be like not the appropriate way to say it, but there is this kind of like leveling off of particular social relations such that everyone can relate on these particular points that your actions do have, if not consequences, they have, there's standings in righteousness that your actions take, and that retroactivity is sort of like a way of, it's like a different way of seeing your actions. And in that way, it's a way of reconstituting your identity, right? Because if your identity is your position within like in a social milieu, well, your actions issue from that. But this kind of like reverses that in a way, right? Because now you're not thinking about your actions in terms of like, well, I'm a king, so I just get to do these things. But now it's like, oh, now my actions actually follow from this consideration that they'll be judged in the end, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? And that again, that judgment is one that becomes, universal across like all persons and isn't like, I can travel from, it's by a certain point in the historical record, I can travel from Spain to Italy to Israel and expect the ethical codes to be relatively similar. With there's obviously always going to be cultural differences, but they're going to be relatively similar within the context of, within the context of there being an overarching religious structure that kind of hinges on all that ethical coding. And then, the last part, like I want to talk about as well, was, obviously this idea of identity, right? That, we kind of already hinted at it. All persons can have, a personal relationship with God, and that, station, you know, familial station, like legal station, power station, all that kind of stuff becomes upheaval. Eventually it solidifies again, but there's a serious period where obviously near the end of the Roman Empire, where a lot of this stuff becomes like, you know, upheaval, you know, aristocratic Roman families break down, you know, borders, you know, obviously break down, the identity related to, you know, the primary glue of, you know, this part of the world at the time, you know, of that being the Roman Empire, living under this imperial bureaucratic structure militaristic and cultural structure, really, you know, and all the hierarchical and points of identity within that hierarchy really become upheaved by, you know, the introduction of this new religious and moral framework.
Yeah, and this new kind of, like, a new kind of identity technology, we might almost say, right? Because now people are having their roles no longer considered sort of as these eternal things which your actions just follow from. You now have a new bearing or like standard for your actions, which is more or less universal. And that's going to, when there's already like material reasons that the Roman Empire is breaking down, this is really going to like chip away at people's identification with, you know, the state, with their families and whatnot. And they're going to start, there's almost going to be like a, well, there's going to be an emergence of a new Christian world at this point, right? I mean,
that's effectively what happened. And I mean, and one of the big things too, is I think like, you know, paganism at the time never had any kind of unifying structure. Like sometimes we talk about like, you know, bureaucracies and, you know, power structures on the show and that kind of stuff. And one of the greatest examples of a formation of a power structure really is the formation of like of the Christian unified Christian church, you know, in the kind of the 5th, 6th, 7th century, right? Where you really get this unified central bureaucracy that has moral and, you know, and lots of other kinds of authority that sort of spreads its tentacles, you know, all throughout the kind of Mediterranean Greco-Roman world, right? And all these, you know, churches and outposts and you know, cathedrals and whatever, all the way back to Rome, effectively, in many cases, you know, they're all following the party, for lack of a better way of saying it, they're all following the party line, right? And so you start to see within this a kind of unified cultural spread as well, and a unified, you know, this is the Canadian philosophy, but a unified moral spread too, in terms of what is and is, you know, is not acceptable, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And that really shifts, and as well as too, in terms of identity, as, you know, we talk about how there's different, you know, within any sort of like society and hierarchy, there's going to be different power structures and positions. Well, now you have this new position, right? Like, obviously, there was always a sort of religious pagan zone or whatever you want to call it. But really, you get the formation of effectively the church corporation that spreads out, you know, across the land. And that offers new opportunities for, you know, not just employment, but also, you know, power and the exercising of power and position within society, right?
Yeah, because it's been constructing sort of new, like, almost like social infrastructure for belonging to a new and emerging world, right? I mean, the religions of the past, they're almost like kind of, I almost think of them as like innocent in a way that they don't have the sort of self-consciousness that Christianity had, where it has this imperative to spread itself culturally, to go and save souls or something like that. Whereas,
well, the evangelism of Christianity is like a central, and it's almost like, it seems to me now, I'm not a pagan scholar, but every time I read or hear about pagan religion as practices, it almost seems that this kind of like more niche, like cultural practice, like it's one of the things that you do in your life that's kind of part of life, and it's more of a habitual practice, cultural thing, But it's not central to your everyday decision making.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same kind of like central bearing that Christianity does, because it's less about, like, I think we've talked about this a bit on the show before, but like it has to do with the sort of cyclical nature that pagan religions form under, right? Because the phenomena that those are responding to and that they're considering divine are like the natural cycles of the world, right? Whereas in Christianity, there is this historical moment. It's a relation. It's recognizing a kind of divinity in each other that allows for the universality of it. And that gives it very different stakes, and it gives it a very different time, like a different time structure. It's rectilinear in that sense, for reasons that, I mean, we probably can't get into right now, but there is a very, like, the stakes are very different. In a pagan religion, it's not your main preoccupation because you just live in, immersed in a world where these phenomena are represented divinely by the different gods, and they're always polytheistic, right, the pagan religions, because the world is a multitude of things. But in monotheism, because it's sort of, it's so focused on a single point, and that point is the divinity in the relation we have to others, it gains a new consciousness, basically.
So this has been the Canadian Philosophy Show, and I've been your host, along with Brandon, as well as been hosting, and we hope you'll tune in next week.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
The fluting song of the wood thrush is an ethereal sound of summer in North America. From April to September, these robin-sized songsters serenade deciduous forests of the eastern U.S. and Canada. Each fall, they migrate to rainforests from southern Mexico to Panama, where they call to each other from the underbrush. For wood thrushes, not just any woods will do. They depend on large blocks of intact forest throughout their range. Unfortunately, wood thrushes are losing habitat as humans convert vibrant forests to pastures, mines, and urban developments. As the remaining forests become smaller and scattered, the wood thrush are left with less food and more threats from predators. We can help wood thrushes and forest birds everywhere by conserving and restoring woodlands throughout the Americas. That includes planting native trees in urban green spaces and buying bird-friendly coffee that's cultivated without destroying the crucial habitats that support the wood thrush's priceless song. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support comes from Wild Delight Bird Food, offering a variety of blends designed to mimic the natural resources wild birds crave. Available at Chewy.com.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
Speak up. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.